Good morning, everyone. For those that don't know me, my name is Jonathan Zimmerman. I'm one of the pastors here at Mosaic. I don't get to preach that much because oftentimes I'm upstairs with your children. Speaking of which, where are my trekkers at? Trekkers, I see trekkers hidden there. All right, trekkers, they know that I told them upstairs earlier, if you manage to remember one of the points Pastor Jonathan said, I have chocolate candy for you. So I have guaranteed memories. And if you're like, hey, I want to be a trekker, well, I'm sorry, you have to be in third to fifth grade there. But anyway, we're continuing our study in Daniel this morning, and we are today in chapter number 3. We've been following Daniel and his three friends from their abduction and carrying away to Babylon through the rise and influence in Babylon. And we've seen how God's chosen to spread the fame and the greatness of His name through these men, faithful that they are in a dark place. And chapter 3 continues the story. It's going to focus back now on Daniel's three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So we're going to go here to chapter 3. Together I'll be reading some verses. It's kind of a longer story, so we'll be summarizing some of that and circling back to it as we continue through the sermon here this morning. So let's go to Daniel chapter 3. We'll start in verse 1 in our story here. Daniel chapter 3, verse 1. It says in Daniel chapter 3, verse 1, King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. And he set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come up to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then, basically all those same guys, the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, justices, and magistrates, and all the officials, in other words, everybody and their brother was supposed to be here, gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O people, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, the pipe, the lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. Therefore, as soon as all peoples heard the sound of the horn, the harp, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, all those musics again, every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up." So you're immediately kind of captured by this image of this giant golden image that Nebuchadnezzar sets up. And it's important to tie this back to what we studied last week in Daniel chapter 2. If you remember, Pastor Jamie walked us through that. And Nebuchadnezzar has this dream that Daniel's able to interpret from God. And there's this great giant statue with multiple different kinds of gold. And Daniel explains to Nebuchadnezzar that the head of gold is him. It's the Babylonian Empire. Well, it's quite interesting that we're immediately the next chapter, we see Nebuchadnezzar set up an entire statue of gold. Because here's the thing. When you're just the head of gold on a statue, the message there is pretty clear. Your kingdom will end. You are finite, and your greatness has an expiration date. So, and Nebuchadnezzar responds, it seems, rather directly by setting up this statue, declaring to everyone that he is the exact opposite of that. He is indeed God, and his kingdom will not end. So let's continue on in our story. We see in verses 8 through 12, there's an accusation that's made against these three friends. And the accusation is made that they didn't bow down. Everyone else did. They didn't bow down. It says in verse 12, "These are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you, for they do not serve your gods or worship the golden image you have set up." So there's an accusation there. And Nebuchadnezzar gets pretty mad, pretty bent out of shape. Gives them a second chance in verses 13 through 18. Says, hey, go ahead and bow down before this. We'll forget it, and you'll be good to go. But they respond, if you look at verse 18, skip down to that, it says, their friends responding, "But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." So there's a sentence pronounced on them in verses 19 through 23. As the king had promised, they're thrown in the fiery furnace. He makes it super hot, so hot it burns up the guys that they're throwing them into the fiery furnace. And then it starts getting a little weird. For Nebuchadnezzar here. Not only do they take and get thrown in the fiery furnace, but turns out they start walking around, they don't burn up, and a fourth person shows up. We'll talk about that a little bit later. And so there's this twist to the story and this great deliverance that God does for the friends. He delivers them from the fire. And there's this great testimony that King Nebuchadnezzar makes in verse 28 where it says, Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants, who trusted in him and set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship God except their own gods." So Nebuchadnezzar makes this great declaration of God's power once again that he had just said in chapter 2 as well. So maybe you've heard this story before. I think it's often one that's super familiar if you've had any exposure to church or maybe just through the culture. And so what's the point, right? It's like an adventure story, right? Like most of that first part of Daniel. It's just this adventure story. And if so, then the point of the story is that God will deliver his people from danger, right? And persecution if they just have enough faith. That's how we grew up understanding it, maybe. That's how I grew up understanding it. But there's a problem with that. The stories of Daniel and his friends aren't examples. They're not examples. They're exceptions. So let's be honest. Regardless of how much faith you have, your odds of surviving a fiery furnace, a den of lions, or the face-to-face confrontation with an egomaniacal despot like King Nebuchadnezzar here, they're pretty bleak. They're pretty bleak. The problem with seeing this story and the stories in Daniel as an adventure not only obscures the main point, but it teaches a blatantly false message. That blatantly false message would be, hey, if we do the right thing, God won't let anything bad happen to us. He'll rescue us from the fiery furnaces of life, from the lion's den of persecution, and from difficulty. And the reality is, nothing could be further from the truth. Instead, Daniel 3 sets out the stage for some big questions about suffering. The ones I think we're often afraid to ask out loud, if we're totally honest. Do I believe that God can and will deliver me from my suffering? But what if He doesn't? Is He still God? Does He still care? When God doesn't deliver me from my suffering, when He doesn't fix the situation, when He doesn't answer my prayer, is He still a God worthy of my love and devotion? So I think there's some answers to some tough questions about suffering in Daniel chapter 3 that we're going to explore this morning. Let's jump back to our passage. Let's look at verses 8 through 12. We're going to read that together. Explore some of these things I think God has for us in Daniel chapter 3. It says in verses 8, "At that time, certain Chaldeans," these are the accusation is made, "came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, 'O king, live forever.'" They're buttering this guy up. "You king, you have made a decree that every man," they want to be really precise about the instruments, "the horn, the pipe, every time they hear the horn, the pipe, the lyre, the trig, and the harp, the bagpipe, and every kind of music, they shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship will be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And there are certain Jews who you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and these men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image you have set up." And I think a key thing for us to grasp from Daniel chapter 3, from our story this morning, is that suffering is certain. Suffering is certain. Think about that for a second. It's kind of one of those, gee, thanks, Pastor Jonathan. That's really encouraging, right? What a bummer. Why should we expect suffering? Why is suffering certain? We should expect suffering. It's certain because suffering is a natural condition of the world we live in. Kind of at a meta level, the 10,000-foot view, the world aches and groans with brokenness and sin leaves us broken and dysfunctional. And the ugly reality is that the sins of others affect those around them and far beyond, often impacting people who had nothing to do with it. In the case of Daniel's friends, we see from chapter 1, they've been swept up in this Babylonian world into this empire that overtakes their land of Judah. And they're in this spot and they've suffered the indignity. Pastor James walked us through this in chapter 1. They suffered the indignity of a forced identity, a name change, relocation to a foreign land, re-education, and even they became eunuchs. They were castrated and their life was changed. What they thought their future was going to be radically changed, even physically. Why? Why? Tells us in the first two verses of Daniel chapter 1, that this would be the sins of others, the sins of their nation. And sometime after the events of chapters 1 and 2, we now find our friends here, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, dealing with yet another dimension of suffering, pressure to conform, pressure to bow down to a false god. And through the story so far in chapter Daniel, they previously demonstrated wisdom and discernment, determining which hills are the ones to die on. We saw that in chapter 1. There's so much they could adapt and learn from, they figured out, and enabling them to influence and minister in the place that God had put them. But some things they could not compromise on. Their faith in the practice of God's laws, and here in chapter 3, the command to worship another god, an idol. So they're suffering from the sins of those around them, the world that they're in. They're suffering from these accusations from the people that have an agenda around them. We also should expect suffering. Suffering is certain because suffering is a natural condition we have as people living as exiles in this world, as God's people living in exiles in this world, in a kingdom where we're pressured to assimilate at every bend. See, Jesus told us as much, right? John 16:33, you will have suffering in this world. But take heart, I have overcome the world. So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, Daniel's three friends, they're living exiles, literally, in a foreign land. And it's clear from chapter 1 that they are set apart for culture or conversion. It's clear the culture they're in has every intention of assimilating them. That's the whole point of them being there. You need to realize, my friends, you need to realize the culture you live and work and play in is hard at work assimilating you as well. You must know what you believe and where God says there can be no points of compromise. Students, the culture is at work to take and assimilate you in school, where every narrative and perspective on sexuality and gender is tolerated and promoted, except for one that maybe holds to a biblical narrative. It's assimilating you at work, my friends, when you feel the pressure to dish that gossip on the coworker, sacrifice your integrity to lie on whatever that report might be. It's what a good employee would do, right? It's what one who wants to do to get ahead, and everyone wants to get ahead. It's what everyone's doing. The pressure from the culture is assimilating you into its shape. It's shaping you. It's assimilating you what you laugh at in entertainment so you think about it lighter in real life. The culture is assimilating you when you feel that pressure, the 24/7 news cycle, right? The next big thing, the next big event, the next election, the midterm, the Supreme Court decision, who's running in 2024, your guy, your gal, let's hang our hopes on them. They're assimilating you into the culture and into their narrative. Maybe you're here this morning and the expectation that God's people will suffer resonates with you because you are in deep suffering. Some of you are in the trenches right now, right? A trenches with a child who struggles daily in development and encouragement issues. There's days of joy, but there's so many days of setback too, right? And you have more questions than answers sometimes. No forward progress to a diagnosis. Or maybe it's that child that despite many tears and prayers and help refuses to do what's right. They keep going back to the destructive patterns. Maybe you've been unemployed or underemployed or homeless for so long that you can no longer remember what it's like to not have to worry about the next bill or the next thing, the next meal. Maybe you're dealing with physical or mental health problems that seem like a dead end, right? It's been so dark for so long and you don't have any answers about the path forward out of that never-ending darkness. Or maybe you're here this morning and you're more like in the season of life that I'm in. I've been through times of difficulty, but nothing that's like tragic, deep suffering that I know many of you have gone through. And right now, life seems pretty good if I'm honest. And if I'm vulnerable and honest a little bit, that's kind of why I've struggled with this passage and where I was pretty sure where God wanted me to preach it. Because I feel a little bit unqualified to take and convey this message. But the reality is here, my friends, that there is only two types of people here this morning. Those that are going through suffering and those that will. There's only those two types. And regardless of which one you fall in, this message is for both of us. It's for you. It's for me. Suffering is something that God's people should expect. Suffering from the overall brokenness of this world and the specific opposition in the kingdom of this world. And no matter what precautions you take, how hard you work, how well you care for your body, how well you shelter your family, something will inevitably ruin it. Something will come to threaten that. And if you and I aren't facing it now, sooner or later we will, because we are to expect suffering. And if we are to expect suffering, there are some absolutely vital things that we need to grasp, I think, that are revealed about how to expect suffering from Daniel's three friends. Let's go back to our passage. Let's go back to verses 13 through 15 for a minute. It says, "Then Nebuchadnezzar, in verse 13, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought forth. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, 'Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image I have set up? Now if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, the pipe, the lyre, the trigon, the harp, the bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?'" See, it's essential for us to understand not just that suffering is to be expected, but suffering is revealing. Suffering is revealing. Think about that for a second. What does suffering reveal in our lives? What does suffering reveal in our lives? See, if we acknowledge the fact that suffering is to be expected by God's people, we also need to come to terms with another hard reality, and that is the implications that built into us, hardwired into us, is this desire to avoid suffering, get out of suffering. And sometimes that's good, right? Because if I'm hurting, I'm going to go get healing. If I'm sick, I'm going to get a doctor. But there's a dark side to that hardwired thing, that hardwired avoidance to suffering. We try to avoid embarrassment, difficulty, and trials. Confronted with suffering, my instinct is to flee, to compromise, to excuse, to ignore, to distract, to anesthetize, to self-medicate, or 100 million other ways to avoid suffering. And the reality is that when confronted by suffering, I will run to something that I feel will deliver me from it. And that something is essentially what the Bible tells us is an idol. It's a false god. It'll make me feel better. And Daniel's three friends are confronted with the same situation. Their suffering was literally an idol, right? It's a statue made out of gold, this false god that Nebuchadnezzar has set up. An idol that really embodied the call to compromise and conform, to assimilate. So where do these three men look to for their rescue? That's why I emphasize the second half of verse 15 there. It's so important. It's the linchpin phrase upon which this whole story rotates. That second half of verse 15 where it says, "Who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?" Who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? And in this challenge, Nebuchadnezzar helpfully distills the friend's dilemma into its essence. This is a confrontation between God and an idol. Who will they choose to run to resolve their suffering? Will they compromise and bow down to an idol? Acknowledge by their actions that Nebuchadnezzar is the one who can deliver them from this suffering? Or will they hold on to the truth they know about God and His command to worship Him alone? In your suffering right now, what are you tempted to go to for deliverance besides God? For me, in the face of suffering, I tend to run to things that are more tangible and immediate and real than God's affirmation. Something that I can control, something that does what I expect it to do every time. This summer, God used some of bit of suffering in my life to reveal one of those things that I go to for deliverance besides Him. Some of you may know I really enjoy working out, specifically weightlifting. I have a whole gym kitted out in my garage. I love to do weightlifting, barbell work. And this summer, I experienced a shoulder injury, impingement on my left shoulder, that actually ended up devolving really quick beyond that into a serious loss of strength. My physical therapist was working with me, and we thought we had basically a C5, C6 bulge, and I dramatically lost the strength of my arm, about 80% of the strength of my left arm, like overnight, just kind of really freaky. And I had to grapple with the reality that one of the idols I run to when suffering is my own body. And that's not because I have like the chiseled body of a Greek god or something going on here, but because my body's consistent. It does what I want it to do every time. When I go to work, it does what I want it to do. When I work out, I can put stress on it and it performs. It does what I want it to do. It's consistent and tangible. It always does what I've demanded of it, whatever stress I put on it. So what happens when you run to that idol and it literally falls under the weight you put on it? After scrambling around, kind of looking for something else tangible, depend on my physical therapist, whatever else, something else tangible to lean on, God really started working my heart with that, and He gave me Psalm 73:26, where it says, "My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever." And He used that to kind of push me back towards running to Him instead of going back to here where it fails, where it will fail time after time, sooner or later. How about you? How do you answer Nebuchadnezzar's challenge? Who is the God you are looking for to deliver you out of the suffering that you are in? So your suffering reveals where you look for rescue. And the answers from Daniel's three friends show who they believe would rescue them. Let's go back to our verses. Let's go back to verses 16 through 18. It says in verses 16 through 18 of chapter 3, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, 'O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. And He will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image you have set up.'" And I love this response from the three friends, right? Their response is essentially, God can deliver us from this, but if He chooses not to, if He chooses us to continue in this suffering, He's still God, and we'll still worship Him alone. A key point in the Daniel chapter 3 story is that suffering is purposeful. Think about that for a second. How can there be purpose in suffering? How can suffering be purposeful? I think suffering is purposeful because God uses it to confront the central orientation we have to idolatry in our hearts. Do I see God primarily as a ticket to the life I want? A transactional faith where I give what He wants, right? I put the coins in the slots, I go to church, I worship, I obey, and He responds by making sure that I have a relatively peaceful life, a good job, a solid marriage, obedient kids. And He keeps me from too much in the way of suffering. Basically, the God that conforms to my expectations of what life should look like. Or am I worshiping God as He reveals Himself to be? A God so much higher, so much greater, whose ways are not my ways and whose thoughts are not my thoughts, who has a purpose and a plan for me in this suffering. See, the three friends get it. The story shows us that God doesn't necessarily deliver us from suffering, but through suffering often. See, most of us read this story, and maybe it's super familiar to a lot of people, and we kind of know how it ends. And I kind of prequeled that earlier when we started it. We know how it ends, right? Just because we read it. But we got to remember, the friends didn't know how the story ended. They were living it. What they did know is that God's character is still the same. He's good and faithful, merciful and loving. And yet, He has the three of them experience all the horror of being the three to stand up. Remember that big long list, satraps, governors, ministers, all everybody and their brother are all there. They're all bowing down and they get to be the three that don't. And they get to experience all the horror of getting tossed into a fiery furnace. They didn't know how it was going to end. They didn't know they were going to burn up. But because we do know how it ends, we read the story, we get this window into seeing some of what God's purpose was here that they didn't get to see. Look at verses 28 through 30. 28 through 30 in chapter 3. And it says, "King Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, 'Blessed be the God of Shadrach.'" This is after they're delivered, after they didn't burn up in the fiery furnace. "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent His angel and delivered His servants, who trusted in Him, and set aside the king's command, and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. Therefore I make a decree, any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb." As a side note, Nebuchadnezzar really apparently liked to tear people limb from limb. That's over and over in this. "And their house is laid in ruins, for there is no other God who is able to rescue us in this way." And then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. So some of God's purpose was obviously the glorification of His name. Even though the nation of Israel is this defeated footnote in history right now that's burned down, He yet declares the glory of His name through them. And He works for the friends' good as they're promoted and they have more opportunity to serve Him in that land. And yet, the response to suffering is an essential part of what God uses to declare the glory and the power and the name. And this takes us to something that's truly unique and beautiful about Christianity, and that is that there is meaning in suffering. There's meaning in suffering. Tim Keller, in his book, Walking with God Through Pain and Suffering, says this, and I love this. It says, Christianity teaches that contrary to fatalism, suffering is overwhelming. Contrary to Buddhism, suffering is real. Contrary to karma, suffering is often unfair. But contrary to secularism, the dominant religion, quasi-religion of our day, suffering is meaningful. There's purpose to it. And if faced rightly, it can drive you like a nail deep into the love of God and into more stability and spiritual power than you can imagine. See, this is the beauty of the gospel, right? The good news about Jesus. I talked earlier about how I haven't experienced much tragic suffering in my life. Well, I know others of you certainly have, but every one of us is in the greatest suffering, right? Every one of us experienced the greatest form of universal suffering, which is sin, our own sin. And Jesus came as a suffering servant to rescue me, rescue you from our sin, from the greatest form of suffering that there is. So we Christians, we don't ignore the reality of suffering. We embrace its purpose. We embrace its meaning in the context of God's promises for us. Promises that revolve around a crucified, resurrected Savior. Let's go back to our passage. Let's look at verse 16 real quick. Verse 16, we read this a little bit earlier, but I'll hit it again. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. Then jump down to verses 23 through 25. It says, And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into a burning fiery furnace. And then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished. He rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, Did we not cast three men into this fire? And they answered and said to the king, True, O king. And he answered and said, But I see four men unbound, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods. And this is the most exciting point of the Daniel 3 story. And that is the fact that suffering is promise-filled. Suffering is promise-filled. That's why I love like the friend's response in verse 16, right? They say, Oh, Nebuchadnezzar, we don't have any need to answer you in this matter. In other words, hey, we don't really have to make up an answer here. We don't have to give you an answer. Our minds are made up. We're so confident in God's presence and His faithfulness, His promises, the suffering, the pain, even your threat of death in the fiery furnace has no weight. So what promises could be so strong to them that they had no fear? They had no fear of everything that the king could threaten them with and respond in that way. See, God promises Himself to His people in their suffering. And that's the amazing thing that happens here, right? These friends get tossed in, and it gets a little weird, like we said, for Nebuchadnezzar in verses 24 through 25, because not only do these dudes not get burned up, but suddenly a fourth person shows up. And what the heck's going on, right? This is what theologians would tell us is called a Christophany. Literally, it's a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus Christ. Christ Himself joining these men in the fiery furnace, the fourth person being the Son of God, present with them in their suffering. He's literally, physically there with them. And this is the crux of the whole story of Daniel 3, right? Don't miss this, my friends. Remember we said second half of verse 15, who is the God who will deliver you from my hands is so key. This is the other key thing, right? This is not a feel-good adventure story. We said that in the beginning about three friends who faced down a tyrant king and were miraculously delivered by God because of their faith. No, the whole point of the story here, the whole point of the Christophany is God's answer to Nebuchadnezzar's question in verse 15. Who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? And God answers, who can deliver you from your hands, Nebuchadnezzar? Who is the God who can deliver me from my suffering today? How does He answer? He answers by sending His own Son to be in the fiery furnace with them. Who is the God that can deliver you out of my hands, Nebuchadnezzar? The Son of God is Jesus Christ. So why is this important? Why is this important, my friends? Well, it's because when we suffer, we want rescue. That's hardwired into us, right? We talked about that a little bit ago, that if we accept the fact that suffering is certain, we also need to embrace the fact that it's hardwired into us, that we want to escape suffering. And that can be good, but it also can be super bad. So when we want suffering, when we suffer, we want rescue. But here's the problem. Rescue without God's presence, it's just escapism. Rescue without God's presence, just escapism. But rescue with God's presence is salvation. Rescue with God's presence is salvation. And this salvation is the promise of Christianity. A promise so strong that all the suffering of this world pales in comparison to it. See, suffering is at the heart of Christianity. Suffering by a God who sent His Son in the world to experience our sorrow, our pain, our brokenness, our isolation, our loneliness. Years before Daniel and his friends would be carried off to Babylon as prisoners, the prophet Isaiah spoke of a suffering servant who would come to break the power of sin and heal the suffering of the world. It says in Isaiah 53, 3 through 5, the prophet Isaiah speaking of Jesus Christ who would come as the suffering servant, He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, as one from whom men hide their faces. He was despised. We esteemed Him not. Surely He has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, and yet we esteemed Him stricken, smitten by God and afflicted. But He was pierced for our transgressions, and He was crushed for our iniquities. And upon Him was the chastisement that brought us peace. And with His wounds, we are healed. See, Jesus Christ was God Himself in flesh. And He died in the ultimate act of suffering, bearing the penalty of your sins, of my sins, upon Himself. And He rose 3 days later to declare loudly victory over the power of sin and suffering. Resurrection, my friends, is not just consolation, but restoration. Restoration, a new life, love, loved ones, goods, and the beauty of this life that have been taken away from you by suffering. Restoration of friendship, relationship, restoration of body and spirit. Restoration to new, unimaginable levels of joy, strength, and glory in His kingdom. Resurrection and Christ's finished work on the cross promises us restoration. See, God's presence, my friends, is what we most need in suffering. And it's that presence exactly that is promised to us in Jesus Christ. The one walking in the fire with you today. One walking in the fire with me today. Promises His followers that we never have to suffer alone. That no matter how dark, how uncertain it might be, we are guaranteed His presence through His Son, Jesus Christ. Let's pray.